I'm waiting for that hush that falls over a room. There it is. Very nice. All right. My name is Mark Anderson. I want to welcome you if you haven't been here before. There are a number of strange faces here and some unfamiliar ones. And if you haven't been here before, I'm glad you came. I would like to make an assumption about you. And the assumption is this, that coming to a conference like this as a non-Christian has got to be a nightmare. It's session after session after session, a little bit of gym time, a little bit of social activity, but a lot of teaching. And as much as it might be a nightmare for a non-Christian, it's maybe only slightly less a nightmare for someone who isn't a committed Christian. So I'm going to make an assumption about the people in this room and the people downstairs, and that is this. If I asked you if you are interested in a life in which you do great things for God, your immediate answer would be yes. I'm going to assume in part that's why you're here. Yeah, there are some guys here, there's some gals here, there'll be some social time, but I hope a large part of why you're here is the beautiful seasonal attractions of Sudbury, and really that you're serious about what you do with your life for God. Now, I know most of you are here because I had that really exciting come on where I told you I was going to tell you about something called the Pareto Principle. Broadly speaking, here it is. We'll talk about it for the rest of this session in a variety of ways, but broadly speaking, here it is. In any organization, a very small minority of the people do the vast majority of the work. You might have heard it as the 80-20 rule. It's maybe more precisely expressed this way, mathematically, that the square root of the number of people in an organization do roughly 80% of the work. So here's how it works in a business. If you have 10 employees and you have a goal in mind, about three of them will do 80% of the work. That may be not a nightmare situation. A little less than half your staff working hard. Well, what happens when you get to 100 people? Now 10 of them are doing 80% of the work, right? You get to 1,000 people. You get a big corporation. Now you've got a real problem. But this principle seems to hold true across the board. And I want to suggest to you that the Pareto Principle often applies to gatherings of God's people. I want you to think about your home youth group or your home assembly or wherever you meet. And think about the work that gets done in that place. The vast majority is done by a very small number of people. And I know that I can look around my home assembly and I can say, if these 10 people were taken out of it, just about everything would fall apart. I don't know if that's true for you in your home assembly, but it seems to be true across the board and across organizations. And that would suggest that in a room like this, where maybe there's 150, 160 young people, about 12 of you will do something great for God. I'd love it if those numbers were higher. So maybe I'm only speaking to a very small minority this morning. And many of you, like many of the rest of us, we'll live lives that are filled in part with frustration and unfulfilled purposes and less joy than you ought to have and a sense that maybe you've missed or you don't have the meaning you'd like to have. Okay, so that's the heavy part. This summer, for the first time in a very long time, I went back to the Canadian National Exhibition with my family. Anybody go to the CNE? Anybody? Yeah, see, this is why it's dying. We hadn't been for years. We're not big ride people, but they have a food building there, and I am definitely a big food person, like deep-fried Snickers bars. Like, it's awesome, right? I would spend my whole time in the food building, given my choice. But I have a redhead, and I have a son, and they don't always want to stay in the food building. So we ended up in the farm building. And, you know, it's different animals. You go look around. There's some strange smells, and I don't take many pictures. I'm not a terribly sentimental person in that way. My wife takes most of the pictures in the family, but there was a pen there that had a number of horses in it, and there were two signs on the pen that immediately caught my attention and made me laugh. Maybe they won't make you laugh. But let me show you the first sign. It is this one. Did you know the first horses evolved 60 million years ago? That was the first time. That didn't really make me laugh. I mean, you hear lots of evolutionary talk. You turn on the National Geographic Channel, there it is. But the problem was it was right beside this sign. Halflinger horse, name May, age approximately 4 years. I love that, man. It's the word approximately. That just made me smile. I want to think a little bit. I want to leave you with two key points this morning. And the first is to talk a little bit about truth and what truth is. We tend to think of truth as a 50-50 proposition. Something's true or it's not true, right? So there's a 50-50 chance of anything. That cute girl you've had your eye on, hey, 50-50 chance she's interested. It's true or it's not true, right? Of course, truth doesn't work that way. It's not a 50-50 proposition. We have some truths like this. There are degrees of truth. And let me suggest that we call this first kind of truth that this sign pictures what we call approximate truth. Okay? No one is saying, even the staunchest evolutionist, when they put up this sign, no one is saying that if you could be transported back exactly 60 million years ago from the day I stood in the farm building at the CNE, that I'd be standing on the vast savanna of Pangaea, or wherever it was, and suddenly out of the ether, horses. Boom. Like they were snails before, but that day when I arrived, horses, by the thousands. Nobody's suggesting that, right? I mean, it's ridiculous to argue about evolution in that context. You understand that what they're putting forth, whether you believe it or not, is that around 60 million years ago, there was a process that was going on that would produce the horses we see today. We understand it to mean that. It's approximate truth, and if tomorrow that sign changed to say 59 million or 61 million, no one would say, aha, evolution's false. There wouldn't even be a discussion about it, right? And you see these ages, these epochs that are imagined for the age of the solar system or the universe, they change all the time. And this is the way science works. We don't have, for any scientific truth, as we call it, real certainty. Science is experimental. So I did this once, and it worked this way. When I dropped this, it fell at 9.8 meters per second per second. And then when I did it a second time, it fell at the same speed, and a third time, and the millionth time. And science says, well, we expect for the millionth and first, it'll do the same thing again. But there's really no guarantee. Right? So science gives us a high degree of certainty in some instances. It makes educated guesses in other instances, and science is always willing to be refined and to be changed. So it's not bedrock truth, is it? It's approximate truth. Like, we're trying our best. Okay. This second kind of sign, I wouldn't call accepted truth. I would call this approximate truth, and it's a little more humble. We are absolutely sure about all horses 60 million years ago. We're not entirely positive about this horse born in our farm, who we've named. We don't want to be pinned down to a particular date and time. So this isn't approximate or accepted truth. This is approximate truth, right? So that's a second kind of truth. There's a third kind. It's not accepted. It's not approximate. It's actual. It's the underlying reality of things. It is an accurate and true description of how reality works. Let's talk for a minute about kinds of truth. So there are degrees of truth, accepted, approximate, and actual, right? You can think of, if you want to think of some other accepted truths, you could think about, for example, the idea of a geocentric solar system. The idea that everything revolved around the Earth. That was accepted truth for many years. And in fact, it was regarded as heresy to say anything different. And then we discovered actually things revolve around the sun, right? It's heliocentric, it's not geocentric. So that was accepted truth for a while, and now that's changed. Now we have a different idea. So that's the idea of accepted truth. You could think of some accepted truths in our society today. It is an accepted truth, isn't it, that a diligent, noble, single parent is every bit as good as a two-parent family. Don't you dare say anything different, right? Because that's accepted truth, but it isn't true. You want to hear a horrifying statistic. If you are a child, in a family where there's a step-parent, you are 100 times more likely to be abused. That doesn't mean there are no good step-parent homes. It means that the best kind of home is a home where there's two parents, a mother and a father who love each other. Oddly enough, God's created order. It's accepted truth that it doesn't matter if you have two dads or two moms. But it's not true, right? So there's accepted truth. It's got a certain amount of fudge factor, and it's subject to change. 20 years ago, we didn't believe any of those things I'm mentioning. Now we believe nothing else as a society. So be very careful about accepted truth. There's approximate truth, right? The things that we're learning, the things that we're refining, those things go on. And then there's what I would call actual truth, math. I hate math. But I'll say this for it. It just doesn't change. 2 and 2 was 4 10,000 years ago, and it'll be 4 if we're here in 10,000 more years. And if you say that it's 5, it doesn't make you clever or insightful, it makes you stupid. There's just truth that is, and this is the beautiful thing about truth. When you get right down to the bedrock, it doesn't care what you think or feel. You can fight with truth, you can argue with truth, you can feel that truth is unfair or unkind or cruel, and truth just doesn't care. It doesn't change. So there is bedrock truth. You know, science is trying to find it, and eventually we hope that through scientific experiment we'll come down to the bedrock truth of the physical reality around us. We'll understand the physics and the chemistry and the biology and all those things. Science is on that pursuit. It's trying to find a bedrock truth, and everyone nods and says, yeah, sure, there is bedrock truth, no problem. But it's a process to find it. Okay, kinds of truth. Here's the audience participation portion. By the way, if I start rambling on and you have a question, you know, stick your mitt up or open your mouth, that's okay. I don't want to just have a ramble here. I'd be happy to have an exchange with you. But kinds of truth. Can I ask you, can you think of some categories of truth? I've mentioned a couple already this morning, but who's got one? Shout it out. Nothing. Sure. Sure. Mathematical truth we talked about, right? The idea of sort of a bedrock truth. How about this? Okay, we'll start with one I already mentioned, scientific truth. Talked about that a little bit, how science is trying to refine things. What about this kind of truth, historical truth?
That can also be, historical truth can also be accepted, not necessarily actual and not necessarily also approximate. We all
Boom.
Agree.
Boom.
Because history is written by the way people who say, for war as example, people who win.
Yes.
Yep.
So you have a big controversy going on in the States right now that many of you are probably aware of, where people are saying these statues that were put up to these people who fought in the Civil War should be torn down. They're offensive to us. They shouldn't be commemorated. Well, 20 years ago or 100 years ago, it was fine to commemorate them. Did historical truth change? Well, our perspective on it did. And historical truth is not scientific in that sense. It's not experimental. You can't experiment with history. But you go back and you find the evidence. You dig up the scrolls, or you uncover the tablets, or you, you know, locate the city, or whatever it happens to be. Historical truth, ideally, is based on evidence. And it can change as we discover more evidence. It's a different kind of truth, maybe, than scientific, right? So that's a kind of truth. But you're onto something, because these kinds of truth all carry different degrees. Right? So... Yes.
Maybe true then, but not true now. Or
yes.
Years ago.
Yes.
It
does seem idiotic, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah. There is underlying everything, I mean, underlying all of science.
Well, common sense is taking away common sense.
Yes, yeah. So I think science would sort of humbly confess we don't have the real truth, but it would never say there isn't a real truth below that. If we didn't know the melting point of ice, we just had a rough approximate, like when we put a flame to this, things melt. When you make it really hot, things melt. It doesn't mean there isn't a melting point. It means we just haven't found it yet. We haven't measured it yet. We don't have the instruments to measure it yet. So most scientists would not say there's no underlying truth, right, in regard to science. But in terms of other categories, that comes up all the time, and we'll come to that. So scientific, historical truth, mathematical truth, I think that's the closest we come to bedrock, where it's unarguable. You know, you hand in your math exam... Like, you either got the marks or you didn't. It's not a judgment call. It's It's bedrock, man, right? You got this some right or you got it wrong. End of story. And that's maybe the closest we come to having a sense of what bedrock truth is. But this is what you pointed out. We're told again and again, sure, there's scientific truth, there's historical truth, there's mathematical truth, there is no moral or spiritual truth. That's the one realm in which we are told there are no absolutes. We can't find them. And so maybe a little bit of Baha'i faith and a little bit from the Quran and a little bit from the Bible, maybe they're all pointing at kind of the same thing. If we could amalgamate them, we could maybe approximate the truth. Like, there's a lot of mealy-mouth talking when it comes to moral or spiritual truth. And as you go further in the educational system, you will just encounter more and more and more of that. And that's really the first point that I wanted to make. I'm going to put up a longish quote here. You maybe know the face, right? This is sort of the face of modern atheism. This is Richard Dawkins. And he's going to say exactly what your question was, or exactly what your comment was. The total amount of suffering per year, he says, in the natural world is beyond all decent contemplation. During the minute that it takes me to compose this sentence, thousands of animals are being eaten alive. Many others are running for their lives, whimpering with fear. Others are slowly being devoured from within by rasping parasites. Sounds like lunch around here. Thousands of all kinds are dying of starvation, thirst, and disease. It must be so. In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces, and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. Okay, this is the face of modern atheism, and I grant you this is an extreme position, but these are in his own words. And what's he saying? He's saying there is no moral or spiritual truth. That we just live in a material world and things happen. And so for the three-year-old who gets brain cancer versus the 85-year-old Nazi who lives in comfort in Brazil, there is no difference. It's just kind of what happened. There's no moral judgment to be pronounced because there is, in his words, no good, no evil, no justice, no meaning. That's what he's saying. That's what Dawkins is saying about fundamental moral truth. He says there isn't any. You can't expect it. And this is the mindset, by and large, you will encounter in modern universities and colleges and higher education, and to a great degree in high school. Right? Don't bring your moral pronouncements into this place because there is no fundamental moral reality. If you believe one way, that's fine. Someone else can believe another way. And in fact, if you believe nothing at all, that's perhaps best. It's a denial of any moral truth. And that's what you're facing as a young person in this generation. There is no respect. There's great respect for scientific truth, for historical truth, for mathematical truth. But there is an absolute denial of any moral or spiritual truth. And you need to understand that. And as a Christian, you need to take your stand and say, no, there is. There is.
Historical truth means it's spiritual truth. I always found that there's historical evidence as a for spiritual moral.
Yes.
The things that happen in history that we consider, people who are not religious, are monuments of history that have actually happened. That
yes.
That actually relate to it. Different things. There's so many lists.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, you can take almost any principle from the Bible, and it's been proven again and again by history. So, take for example, here's a moral principle. The soul that sins will die. Man, that's pretty plain. Right? It's appointed to a man or a woman once to die. And after that judgment, that's a moral statement, by the way, the second part of that. But what we can discern is that so far, in the first part of the statement, the Bible is 100% accurate. Everyone we know experiences death. Right? It's appointed to a man once to die and after that judgment. That seems a very clear statement of fact. The New Testament will have four times over this phrase, which to me is interesting. It begins by saying, do not be deceived. And that tells me it's going to give me a moral truth in the following phrase. And if I'm not careful, I might be fooled. Right? That's what do not be deceived means. It says, hey, listen, pay some attention. Notice what I'm going to say here. So, here's one that is a moral fundamental truth that I wish wasn't true, and maybe you wish wasn't true, but is true. Here it is. Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Wow. So if I choose to spend my time with people who are making bad spiritual choices, even people who wear the name Christian, even people who attend my local meeting, if they are making poor moral choices again and again, here's what the Bible has to say to me. Don't kid yourself. You will not exalt them. They will degrade you. Their behavior won't improve. Yours will get worse. I wish that wasn't true. Don't you wish that wasn't true? But it is true. And it's just telling us, like 2 + 2 = 4, it's just telling us about the fundamental moral reality of the universe in which we live. And if we're wise, we'll conduct ourselves on that basis. Okay, so here's kind of the summary of how I would put it. You don't have to put it in these words, but here's what I would say. The Bible is a reliable book meant to tell us how to conduct ourselves, how to live with each other, and how to honor the Creator's design. It contains unchanging moral truth that, when faithfully applied, will fill our lives with meaning and purpose. Okay, that's the summary of it. That you can rely on the Word of God to tell you about the moral nature of the world in which you live, and to tell you how you ought to choose and what you ought to do. And it is utterly reliable. John 17:17, the Lord Jesus speaking to people he loves, to his disciples, just before he's going to go to the cross. He prays to the Father, and this is his prayer to the Father. He says, of those he loves who are following him, he says, sanctify them in the truth. That's a big word that means make them different. Use the fundamental moral truth, because that's what he's talking about here. He's not talking about math or history or science, right? He's talking about spiritual truth. He says, Father, I want you to use the spiritual truth of the universe to make these people very different from everyone else around them. Set them apart, using the truth as a tool to do it. And then he says, it's the same sentence, he says, your word is truth. So for the Christian, obeying these principles is meant to mark you out. That was the prayer of Jesus Christ, that it would make you different, that you would choose differently on the basis of this book. A second verse that you know, or a couple of verses. All scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. That's a statement about the sufficiency of scripture. It makes you equal to everything God has for you to do. So listen, go get your degree, go learn medicine, go learn chemistry, go learn whatever you want to learn. There's nothing wrong with knowledge. There's nothing wrong with going to work and having a career and having a family. I hope the Lord blesses your education. I hope he fills your brain with useful facts. But in terms of service for God and what will count for eternity, he says this book is sufficient for every good work. Everything God has for you to do, you can be equipped to do in this book. It does not need university. It does not need college. It does not need higher education. It doesn't need books of philosophy. It doesn't even need preachers or teachers. It needs you to get into this book and trust it and read it and obey it. And if you want to do great things for God, you trust his word and you're made different by it, and you are made sufficient for every work he's ever prepared for you to do. You want to violate the Pareto principle and have 100 kids in this room who go forward for God and do great things, it'll happen to the extent that you get into this book and that you trust it. And when the world says, no, no, that book is wrong, you say, no, that book is right. That's describing the moral, spiritual nature of the universe in which I live, and I trust it. And I know it's functional and I know it works. Okay, so that's the first big idea, is that there is a moral truth that underlies the universe in which we live, and the Bible will describe it for you. And you're asked to obey it and to be made different by it. Okay, that's just a very simple idea, but we've talked about it a little bit. I promised we would talk about icebergs, so we will. You've maybe seen a picture like this before, right? Up above the surface, roughly 10%, here's the Pareto principle again, right? Roughly 10% of the mass of an iceberg is above the waterline. And if that's all we saw, we would think that the wind was the tool that moved that along. So if you went out to the coast of Newfoundland and you watched the icebergs moving along, they move fairly slowly at most times, But you might think, if that's what you could see, if it was just that scene portion of it, that the wind was responsible for moving those icebergs. That's all you could see. But of course, down below the surface, you actually have 90% of the mass. You see how I did the clever math there, right? 10 plus 90, 100%, got it covered. 90% of the mass of an iceberg is below the waterline where you don't see it. And actually what's moving that iceberg far more than the wind is the current, which is also unseen. Right? Whichever way the water is flowing, because that's affecting 90% of the mass of the iceberg, that's really what's going to determine where and how it moves. And that is, incidentally, the unseen and powerful portion of the iceberg, as the Titanic found out. It wasn't so much the above-water collision that sank the Titanic. It was the ripping action below, right, on the hull, that huge, powerful, weighty mass in the water against which it hit. And that's what happened. So you've seen icebergs before. You probably know all that. That's fine. Let's talk about you a little bit. The Pareto principle applies to you. You're like an iceberg. So I see you out there. You all look good. You cleaned yourself up. That's great. What am I seeing? 10% of you? Well, maybe 10% of you physically. What do I know of you if I'm your friend, if I spend time with you? What do I know of you if I'm your brother and I've spent a lifetime with you? What do I know of you if I'm eventually your spouse and I live with you and I see you day to day in good circumstances and difficult circumstances? You know, the truth of it is, even the people who are closest to us see a very small fraction of who we really are. Can I confess something to you that I think is true in your life too? There are lots of thoughts that I have that I don't share with you because they're shameful, or because they're painful, or because they're so deeply personal and I don't maybe trust you the way I should or the way I could. And so I keep a good percentage of who I am hidden. And so do you. You're like an iceberg in that sense, right? So we see a little bit that's above the waterline. What do we see? The mind, the intellect. We see facts acting on you, facts pushing against you. And when we see you move, we think you're moving because of facts, right? Circumstances changed and you made different choices, right? You judge things, you made choices. We tend to think you're a rational person. And when I look in the mirror, I tend to think I see a rational person. I like to think that I'm very scientifically minded, that I assemble all the facts dispassionately. I don't have any pre-existing bias. I assemble all the facts and I look at them and I weigh them out and I determine probabilities and then I choose intellectually and rationally that I will go this way or I'll go that way. But I've come to realize in my life and in your life, that's not true because we're like icebergs. Down below is something the Bible will talk about again and again, called the heart. Now, in our modern parlance, when you get your Valentine's card, there'll be a little picture of a heart, and we just really have limited the meaning of heart to mean our affections, who we like, who we don't like, right? Who betrayed us. But biblically, heart is an incredibly common word, especially in the Old Testament, and it doesn't mean just the affections. It really means the whole person. And it encompasses this idea that you are far more than just a mind, that you are influenced by things that are unseen, and you're influenced powerfully, emotion, tendencies, feelings, things that are kept secret from others and are unseen and unknown, but really direct what you do. Now, that's true for your neighbors, for your peers, for your spouse, all those people around you. They don't see the hidden part. Let me suggest further, it's true for you personally, that you don't even know really why you choose the things you choose. There's some very interesting experiments being done that actually show, which is kind of a, you know, moment, that we react to things, we react to stimulus sometimes faster than we can form conscious thought. And the suggestion is, through a number of experiments, interesting, the suggestion is that the rational mind typically exists not to choose an action, but to justify an action that's already been taken. I can tell you that's been true in my life as I look back on a number of occasions. I do the thing my flesh wants. That's another way to put it. I do the thing my heart wants. I'm always reminded, there's a fellow in Hollywood, it's full of righteous people, as you can tell. Wonderful moral images there. But there's a fellow who made a horrible wreck of his family a few years ago, and they asked him, like, why would you choose to do that? And I'll never forget what he said. He said, the heart wants what the heart wants. That's an honest statement about a horrible situation. Sometimes the heart wants what the heart wants. And we do things, and the mind then makes up a bunch of reasons that sound plausible, that we can tell ourselves so we can still be the hero in our own story, and that we can tell other people when they accuse us of choosing badly, we can say, no, you don't understand. There's reasons I did what I did. But the reasons are often below the waterline, where our friends can't see them, and where we don't even realize they exist. Okay, that's maybe slightly philosophical, and you're saying, yeah, whatever, Anderson. Let me share Jeremiah with you. Okay, you know this verse. The heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick or desperately wicked. Who can understand it? Okay, that's not Anderson saying it. There's some fundamental bedrock moral truth realized in the Old Testament that we are composed in large measure of a deceitful function we don't fully understand and no one else can understand. I hope that worries you a little bit. It worries me. The heart is more deceitful than all else and desperately sick. Who can understand it? Okay, so here is my second big point. We talked about bedrock truth. Here it is, Proverbs 4:23. Man, this verse hits home for me. Solomon has advice. He writes lots of Proverbs. And you go read the Proverbs. I love the Proverbs. They hit you right where they live. They're like a hammer blow. You can just take one verse and it ruins your day. You don't have to like try and figure out what it could possibly mean or, it's just there, like right in your face. So Solomon writes these Proverbs that just hit you like hammer blows. And then he says, here in this translation, in the New American Standard, he says, with all diligence, but you may have in your translation this, which I like better, above all. He has a lot to say to his kids. He has a lot to say to people who are reading his material. And then he says, above all that, he says, the most important thing is to watch over your heart. And he says, the reason you want to watch over your heart, he's not just talking about your affections. He's talking about all those unseen things below the waterline, all the things that affect you. He says, watch over your heart because from it are the issues of life. How will your life go? You want to do great things for God. What will lead you to do great things for God? Your heart, left to its own devices, will not do it. And your heart, Solomon says, is what's going to direct your life. He says, you look back after 40 or 50 years of wasted living, you'll look back and you'll see what directed you down that course was an unguarded heart, was a heart you did not watch out over. He says, watch it with all diligence, man. And here you are. I don't want to insult you when I say this. Teenagers, for the most part, maybe a few years older than that. You know, my life, my chronology is like an iceberg, right? Here we are just one day out of many. You can see that. You can watch that day. But man, I've got 52 years below the surface of built-up decision-making. Lots of bad decisions. You familiar with the concept of inertia, right? Something that's moving tends to keep moving. You make enough bad decisions below that waterline, right? All the history that you can't see, and that is pushing you forward in directions you feel almost powerless to change. Now, as a young person, you don't have all that inertia yet. The train's just getting going. Things are just getting rolling. And you make choices now, they will have dramatic effects when you're 40, 50, 60, 70. You want to do great things for God, get the train rolling today. Start trusting his word. Start investing in his word. Start getting into his word. Watch over your heart with all diligence, for from it are the issues of life. And I tell you a little story. I remember as a young man, just after I'd moved back to Sudbury, I didn't know anyone here, hardly knew anyone in the assembly, and I had an unsaved friend, and it was my custom, I wasn't married at that point, I wasn't expected home at any particular time, it was my custom to leave work and go to my friend's house. My friend was out of work at the time. We'd go down to his basement, and his mom would make us dinner, which was awesome. And we'd watch TV, which was not always awesome, as you know. And I remember sitting there one night, and we were watching a show, and unsurprisingly, it took a very unsavory turn. There were things on screen that were not good for a Christian to watch. And I was sitting there in my chair with my unsaved friend, so I couldn't really have a discussion with him. But I remember thinking about this verse, 2 Timothy 2:22. You know, all the best verses have easy-to-remember references. Like 2 Timothy 2:22. Like, just remember a bunch of twos. And Timothy, you got it covered. 2 Timothy 2:22. These words hit me. Now flee from youthful lusts. Here's how my mind works. I'm sitting there in the chair. What is the metaphysical meaning of flee? How, as a Christian, how do you spiritually flee? I know I should do it. I wonder what that means. Like, how does that get applied to the internal spiritual life? And then I thought, brilliant insight on my part. Maybe it means go home. Like, don't be here anymore. That's brutally practical. So I left. I'm ashamed it took me several minutes of contemplation to realize that it just meant go away. When there's trouble, go away. Young person, flee youthful lusts. It doesn't mean build up the strength of your mind and your resolve and your will so that you can endure any kind of temptation. That whatever Hollywood throws up on that screen, whatever the next YouTube video is in the queue, whatever someone sends you on Instagram or wherever it happens to be, it's not so you can build up your resolve to deal with those things. Here's the spiritual truth of it. You need to run away. You need to not be there. If you're going to do great things for God, you cannot let things affect you below the waterline. You know, they come in below the level of the intellect, and they affect you forever. I love this quote. I don't know who came up with it. Maybe you've heard it. I've heard it said a number of times. If you want someone to know the truth, you tell them. If you want someone to love the truth, tell them a story. Interesting how many times in the Bible the Lord told stories. Interesting how many of those stories really resonate with us. Right? Remember the story of the prodigal son? Yeah, you do. That hits home. That has a story that is hitting you below the waterline, below the intellect. It's speaking to your heart, it's speaking to your spirit, and it's making you into a better person for God's purposes. Now, what happens when the opposite occurs? And you go to the theater. Listen, I'm not judging you for that. I was at the theater not too long ago myself. Okay, confession time. I have a TV in my house. The internet comes into my place too. Okay, so I sympathize. I get it. But think about the things you are letting affect you. Some years ago, my father, well-intentioned, I think, sent us to something called the Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts. They give you a big red binder, right? And you watched movies in a big auditorium with a bunch of other teenagers who weren't sure why they were there. And this binder addressed all the common areas of the teenage life, because I was a teenager then. And the binder was filled with scriptural references. And so there was reasons for them to say, here's what you should avoid. You shouldn't be involved in this. You shouldn't, you should deal with lust in this way, and so on and so forth. All the usual teenage issues. And then there was a tab for music. And I got to tell you, I loved music then, and I love music now. And I loved secular music in particular. Because a lot of the Christian music seemed like a bunch of Me Too guys, right? Like whatever was popular a year ago on the secular charts, suddenly all the Christian bands sounded like that next year. I thought, why not have the real sauce? Why not get the real deal? And I kept looking for reasons why I shouldn't listen to this music. Like, I would always hear people say, oh, it's the beat. You ever hear that? It's the sinful beat. And I think, what are you talking about? Bunch of losers, And they would say, oh, it's the lifestyle of the performer. And I would think, well, you got paintings on your wall by a guy who married six different women. What do you... Like, you don't judge the lifestyle of the guy who painted those paintings. You don't judge the lifestyle of the guys who did classical music. So I'm supposed to worry about rock musicians now? No, it's just good music. Nobody could convince me. And when I got to this Institute of Basic Youth Conflicts, I flipped open the page on music because I was really curious. There's all kinds of listed reasons why I shouldn't listen to rock music and zero biblical references. I thought, What a sham, right? Closed the binder, kept listening to music. Some years ago, I heard Ravi Zacharias say this, and I'll paraphrase it slightly. I wish I could find the original quote again. But man, he nailed me. He said this. He said, "Watch what you listen to and what you look at, because the arts have a way of bypassing the intellect and speaking directly to your spirit." I said, "Okay, you got me." That's why I can't listen to secular music in the same way anymore. Because I know he was right. Man, it hits you past the intellect. It gets past those intellectual defenses. It's not a rational choice. And you cannot unsee what you see today. You cannot unhear what you hear today that is speaking to your heart and speaking to your spirit and affecting you below the waterline. If you want someone to know the truth, tell them. If you want someone to love the truth, tell them a story. The stories you are watching and the stories you are taking in are leading your moral decisions. It's not rational, right? So we have a growing number of young people these days. We could take the survey here, but we won't. Who would say, maybe there's a few of you here, maybe there's a lot of you here, who would say, you know, if two people love each other, let them get married. Who would even see that as a godly choice? Why has that happened? Is it because every sympathetic character that we see portrayed on television is portrayed with a certain preference? Is it because those things that used to be considered perversions are now heralded as brave moral choices? And there are literally parades in which, if you're a politician, you must march or you're unelectable, celebrating terrible lifestyle choices. How did that happen? How is it that Christian young people are on board with that? I'll tell you how it happened. It happened through Hollywood, and it happened through YouTube, and it happened through popular culture. Be very careful what you take in at a young age. You want to be someone who serves God and does great things for God. Okay, you know, we kind of had to come to this, right? "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things." I love that word, dwell. That's where you got to spend your time. Set your sights on the highest possible moral good. Let that be informed by this bedrock, reliable, fundamental truth about the moral universe in which we live. How should we live? This will tell you. How should I choose? This will tell you. Believe it. Obey it. Set your sights at the high point and live that way, because your life is like an iceberg. 90% of it below the waterline, unseen, hidden, being affected by forces you don't choose and you can't imagine. So make those forces good. The promise for the Christian, of course, is that as a believer, you've been indwelt with the very Spirit of God. You know, you had this image earlier on, this image of the iceberg. What do we do? Like, 10% of it, the intellectual portion of it above the waterline, doesn't really affect where it goes or what it does. There's all those hidden forces below, the current that we can't see, the current of popular opinion and popular culture and media, and all those influences that can hit you where you don't even intellectually choose anymore. For the Christian, the Spirit of God comes in and indwells the whole being and fills us and informs us and empowers us. And what really ought to be happening for the Christian is that suddenly that 10% that's above the waterline, that 10% that we actively choose, the intellectual choices we make, by the power of the Spirit of God, which the non-believer does not have, that begins affecting where this whole mass goes. That begins determining the course of your life. Above all these things, guard your heart, for from it are the issues of life. All right, lunch very shortly, and probably some really good bits of Brent's presentation left downstairs so you could sneak down quietly. Let's close in prayer. Father, in a world of uncertainty and moral confusion, we would come to you this morning with gratitude that you have shown us the truth, that it is your desire to sanctify us as believers in the truth. Father, we read the words of John and we understand them to be your words, that you have no greater joy than to hear of your children walking in the truth. We think of the horrible numbers and the horrible reality that, Father, most people will live a life of dissipation and distraction and will miss many of the things you have for them. We don't want to be among that group. We want to be people who serve you and honor you and please you and do great things for you. And so we ask, Father, that you would lead us, that you would empower us, that you would inform us, that we would not forget there is a moral truth that is clear and findable to which we must be obedient. And we ask, Father, that you'd point us in that direction, that you would grace us with the ability to hear you clearly and the grace to obey you frequently. Thank you, Father, for your goodness to us, for a little time together here at this conference. Thank you for Alan and for others who will share the word. But we think, too, of the moments, aside from public teaching, where there'll be just a little conversation or just a little moment that perhaps will set the course of a life. And we ask that by your grace there would be work done here for eternity and that you'd be honored in all that we choose and do. We thank you for the food we'll enjoy downstairs, and we ask you'd part us now with your blessing in our Savior's name. Amen.